Hello again, and thanks for joining me. I'm Rab Houston, and I'm Professor of Modern History in the University of St Andrews here in Bonnie, Scotland. You're listening to one of my podcasts on the history of British psychiatry since the time of the Renaissance. This podcast is the third in the third section of talks, and the section as a whole is concerned to address the question, how did understandings of the causes of mental disorders change over time? Today's podcast is entitled Freud and the Psyche. I talked last time about 19th century developments in the understanding of the brain. If the 19th century had been mostly about physiology and about somatogenic interpretations of mental problems, the early 20th century was the golden age of psychodynamic psychiatry, at least in some parts of Europe and the wider world. Sigmund Freud, whose work is perhaps the best known in this area, is of course a huge figure in the field, but even he had predecessors. And I think the Vienna-based physician Franz Anton Mesmer is usually credited with being the first to unlock the secrets of the psyche that Freud exploited to the full. Mesmer worked at the end of the 18th century and into the early 19th century. He was like a lot of 17th and 18th century thinkers in his belief that humans had within them a spirit or an essence. He called it animal magnetism, and he thought he could manipulate it. Now, in reality, his science was conventional, and a commission of the French government set up to investigate whether he was a charlatan or a real scientist found it sadly wanting. What the French investigation did unleash was the idea that any effect Mesmer's treatments seemed to have was dependent on the patient's imagination. So Mesmer's treatments opened up the patient's unconscious to scrutiny. Later, mesmeric and hypnotic therapies seemed to induce trances in which the otherwise hidden recesses of the mind became accessible. Now, Mesmer had a number of famous successors. They include someone called Jean-Martin Charcot. Charcot used hypnotherapy to treat hysterical women at the Salpêtrière Asylum in late 19th century Paris. Early in his career, Sigmund Freud worked with Charcot. This led Freud to believe that, in female hysterics, the psychoneurosis he diagnosed came from sexual abuse in childhood, memories of which had been suppressed by the women. Now, Freud later rejected this theory, but his belief in the importance of symbolism and the unconscious, especially repressed sexuality in the form of the Oedipus complex, remained central to his psychiatric ideas. Freud's psychoanalytic method involved free association. Free association and the analysis of dreams to get around patient resistance to revealing their unconscious divided self and its suppressed wishes. His 1900 book, the German title of which is Die Traumdeutung, was first translated into English in 1913 under the title The Interpretation of Dreams. It is, arguably, the single most important work of psychiatry ever published. Until Freud, dreaming was seen as prophetic. What was in the dream was a warning of what was to come. Freud continued this emphasis on content, using dreams as a diagnostic tool, a pointer to the inner self uniquely available when resistance to free association was lowered during sleep. The big difference is that Freud looked back rather than forward in time. Now, modern scientists still study dreams. Present-day cognitive neuroscientists study the form of dreams rather than their content. And for those cognitive neuroscientists, the interest lies principally in the problems of the mind. In other words, what is the mind? Rather than in mental problems, which is what interested Freud. Freud's influence has been enormous, though more so in the German lands and, to a lesser extent, the United States than elsewhere in the world. Psychoanalysis was shunned in France, and it was never widely accepted in Britain or in Ireland, though Freud lived in London for a brief period towards the end of his life. He died in London in 1939, and if you're interested, his family home in Hampstead, North London, is now a museum, complete with his famous consulting couch, which is the illustration for this week's podcast. Now, psychoanalysis was extremely time-consuming, and for that reason, it was mainly confined to private practice. The best known public institution in Britain that uses Freudian methods is the Tavistock Clinic in North London. Founded in 1920, it still promotes psychodynamic and social approaches to psychiatry. Most British psychiatrists from Edwardian times onwards thought Freud's emphasis on the libido was nothing short of bizarre. Carrying on the 19th century physiological theories that I talked about last time, British psychiatrists generally leant towards a more somatic interpretation of mental problems, because from their asylum bases they had to deal with far more serious syndromes than the apparently lower grade ones that interested Freud, and of course with many fewer resources. Freudian approaches are, if anything, even less popular nowadays, but through visual mass media in particular, psychoanalysis has contributed to the psychiatrization or the psychologization, the psychologization of many aspects of Western life. Thus, the psychoanalytic couch symbolizes psychiatry for many of us. More importantly than that, psychoanalysis made other contributions. It brought to the fore less high-profile conditions like anxiety and depression, which had previously figured little on the psychiatric horizon. Now, these conditions are, as you probably know, currently the fastest-growing diagnostic categories in modern medicine. Freud's emphasis on childhood experience also represented a new departure in psychiatry, as did his theory that the mind was inherently conflicted. Freud's influence has been profound, but in Britain it was never as great as it was in the German lands. And if anything, the reaction against psychoanalysis in Britain was almost complete by the 1950s and the 1960s, when new pharmacological discoveries made possible the effective treatment of many conditions for the first time. I'll talk about these in a few weeks from now. What matters for the moment is that knowing how the drugs worked allowed scientists to extrapolate to the neurochemical bases of mental dysfunction. For example, the discovery of serotonin in the 1940s laid the foundations for modern neuroscience. Let me make one final observation on psychodynamic approaches to psychiatry. The ultimate causes of most psychiatric conditions may well be neurophysiological and neurochemical. That is the current orthodoxy. But that, to me, is a bit like someone in the 16th century saying that it was all down to God. Not everyone who has the genetic marker for a syndrome such as autism, Alzheimer's, or schizophrenia will develop similar signs and symptoms. Part of the reason is that people respond to environmental triggers differently. Some cope better with adversity than others. Some have more privileged or deprived upbringings, which may hinder or accelerate onset and manifestations. The social and the psychological, I think, may be just as important as the medical or biological, something that has been recognised by practising mad doctors for centuries. I'll bring out the importance of social and environmental factors again in the next block of podcasts, which is about the history of therapies for mental ailments. I hope you'll join me for that.